Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for a little-known baseball team on the south side of Chicago called the White Sox. We write a blog about them called The Catbird Seat for the ESPN Sweet Spot Network, which also still exists. Joining me tonight in Arizona, a unclaimed territory in the southwest United States, Matt Adams.
Hola.
In Manhattan is Nick Schaefer.
Hey.
And joining us from Madison, Wisconsin, is Ethan Spaulding.
What's up?
And I, James Feegan, am joining you from Elkhart. I'm using new headphones that block out sound. It makes my voice sound like it is pounding in my head in a way that's really throwing me off.
I was going to say, sound quality is better on this end.
More confident and less broken down by Elkhart, Indiana.
Theoretically, my headphones would have nothing to do with my sound quality. But...
Well, in your ears, they do.
Yeah, I sound like I'm a god to myself. Anyway, we are on the night before the World Series, which the White Sox have absolutely nothing to do with.
It's not true. There's three former White Sox on the Mets if Juan Uribe makes the playoff roster, and there is a Alex Rios is on the Royals.
There's some tangential White
you
Sox influences.
You said nothing to do with.
I did. Mostly just because I feel like I haven't watched a White Sox game in weeks, and maybe that's why I can, like, feel less beaten down, because I haven't, like, watched them be less than the sum of their parts in a while.
I miss Chris Sale, though.
I don't miss, like, looking like Chris Sale versus TJ House tonight and be like, this is going to be a walkover, and then watching him lose 4-3 somehow. Like, that feeling is gone.
Or if he's playing the Twins and then you lose by 8 or 9.
Yeah, he's out by the third inning, and then
what if
Kyle
we get a
Gibson
season where Chris Sale decides he's not going to be terrible against one AL Central team? How good is Sale going to be that year? Because now it's been one team just completely kills him 2 years in a row.
I feel like I wouldn't know him.
You know, I'm down. Like, if you're asking, do you want my vote? Like, you know, I'll vote for that.
I think next year he's just going to get hammered by the Tigers, and the Tigers are just going to be shit, but they're going to kick Chris Sale's ass.
I think he'd be down with that. The last 2 years it's been like, is really bad against middling team that probably shouldn't be a contender and props up like their bid for a wild card spot by the fact that they win a ton of games against the White Sox.
Yeah, and then you take those sprinkling of games that say like Chris Sale... You know, most teams lose to, and then, like, that team gets some free wins out of it.
Like, I'd rather turn, like, a 60-win team into a 70-win team than have them turn a 75-win team into an 85-win team.
So, the Mets? Like, the Mets are in the World Series for beating the crap out of crappy teams in their division for divisional play repetition.
Well, all their teams in their division wound up being pretty crappy, so...
I mean, every team in the National League, basically, except, like, there were four really good team in the net, four or five really
five,
good teams. Yeah, five. And then every other team was terrible.
Yeah, wait, how many of the top 10 draft picks are coming out of the NL? It's like 7 or 8 of them.
I didn't know it was that bad, but I knew it was. I mean, that makes sense considering the AL with a bunch of 500 teams.
7 out of 10, yeah, and the top four of the top five, including the top three, are NL. And actually, sorry, it's not just 7 out of the first 10, it's 7 out of the first 8. The A's pick fourth, and then they're sandwiched on either side by, you know, 3 and 4 NL teams. That's incredible.
And the AL just has all of the 12 through 17 picks or whatever. Like,
yeah, everyone's just mushed around within like 5 to 7 games of 500.
So something that happened today, Monday night, or Monday today, is that this is the 10th anniversary of the White Sox actually winning the World Series. And our original web designer, Shane Nicholson, who helps us out a lot, gave a shit for not doing anything on our website about the 10th anniversary. And I realized that I kind of felt bitter about it, the idea that I'm supposed to do something or that like there's more honoring that they deserve, which I think is a really fucking awful way to feel about a 10th anniversary of like the best moment of fanhood ever. And I think it's kind of sad that like the Sox situation has made me feel that way, but they're kind of in a situation where There hasn't been anything else to really focus on. So it's not like this is like the 10th anniversary of a team we haven't talked about or haven't revisited. Like, I feel like next year, the St. Louis Cardinals, when it's like the 10th year of that 2016 that made like a really crazy run, but otherwise isn't thought about as being like a very good World Series champion. Like, it'll be nice for when their fans like revisit that team and those guys, because, you know, there have been a lot of good contending Cardinals teams to think about. They probably haven't had a moment to stop and really, like, really cherish that playoff run those guys went on. But for the White Sox, like, this is all we've been, like, talking about. There's, like, 1 to 2 panels at Sox Fest dedicated to this 05 team. Like, every time, any, like, off-season, like, White Sox content on CSN is, like, a World Series tribute or where's Joe Creedy right now and stuff like that. Every, like, guest announcer in the White Sox booth is, like, Aaron Rowan or Creedy or Frank Thomas, who talks about, like, the 05 team. Like, there's nothing else to really discuss. So it's not like this team that's been lost to the sands of time.
There's also the lingering bad taste from the Bears thing that no one lets go of. So, like, if your dad was one of those people that, you know, peaked in high school and was, like, you know, talking about the big game your whole life, you probably wouldn't talk about the big game for the rest of your life if you had that when you were in high school, because you knew how annoying it was. So, like, I sit here in the same place as you, kind of not willing to get all involved with it because of, you know, people are still going on about the Bears situation. Like, that was the, you know, and it's just, it's sad and annoying, and I don't want to do that with the White Sox for the next 30 years.
Yeah, and the organization's done a really good job of tainting a lot of those memories, where it's like it becomes this excuse for their incompetence ever since. Where it's like, well, but yeah, but they won that World Series, so, like, you know, we decided to just keep everything from that unchanged forever, even though it keeps, you know, like, they managed to just, everything is just like a little, the loyalty is taken to this really, you know, sentiment at the expense of competence, and it's frustrating. Like, yeah, it's great that they, well, like, no, I take that back, because they aren't, they're loyal to certain guys to a fault, and then other guys that I actually really care for, they, like, they dump very unceremoniously, and it's not even strategically. Like, they jump, you know, they, you look at their last playoff team in 2008, just as a micro example of this, but, you know, John Danks has sort of become this frustrating, like, shell of what he used to be. The, you know, Jim Thome was such an awesome part of that 2008 team, and they jettisoned him for Mark freaking Kotze. And, you know, Carlos Quentin injured himself and then, like, insaned his way out of baseball. It's just really, it's just frustrating. Like, Canerico stuck around an extra year for, like, a victory lap because all they can do is prop up that one success that they had once. It gets embarrassing, and it's frustrating. It's like, well, are you guys just using this as like carte blanche to be terrible forever?
I mean, Canerico's part of it. I mean, the fact that, like, we have, like, these extended goodbyes for all these guys who are part of that kind of means, like, we're talking about it all the time. Like, we talked about Canerico ad nauseum because we had so many, like, forgive it, like, farewell events for him. And, of course, 2005 was entirely part of that. And the same thing for when A.J. Pierzynski left, and the same thing for when Mark Burley left.
You guys are all being so negative, and, like, I'm about as negative as it gets when it comes to the White Sox, but I kind of, like, just want to be happy about remembering 10 years ago, and maybe it's because I was 10 years old back then, but I kind of, like, want to think back, even if everything's been garbage since. I want to think back about that happily right now. Like, it's something that I'm not against doing right now. I don't. You guys are all so negative.
I actually got to, I only got to 2 games that year because I was, you know, I was living in either Connecticut or Atlanta. And I got to 2 of the 3 games at Yankee Stadium when the White Sox played there. And it was El Duque's first game back at Yankee Stadium. And Rowan made those crazy catches in the first inning. They wound up losing 3-2. And then the second game of that series, I didn't make it to. That was where that guy fell to the upper deck on the netting over home plate and kind of, like, sat there for an inning or something like that. And Matt remembered this. I was talking to him about this, I think. But and then the third game of the series went to the 10th inning. I think Juan Uribe hit a triple and wound up scoring the winning run off of Mayan Rivera because Bernie Williams, like, you know, skeleton was still playing center field for Sentimental Joe Torre. And that was a game where I think Neil Kotz came in and like blew away A-Rod, Sheffield, and Giambi, like 1-2-3. It was those are the in-person memories that I have, just to like try to skew things more positive.
There was something like
Aaron Small started one of those games and was like on fire.
Someone tweeted a stat at me that I had no idea, and this is in part because I can't remember specific things about that season like that, because I was 10. Like, I can't remember specific random games in the regular season, but someone tweeted a stat, like, I think it was Kotz, Polite, Hermanson, and maybe Jenks. Like, the four of them combined for as many innings and a lower ERA than 1999 Pedro. Or something insane like that.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. I mean, you think about it, where like Damaso Marte and Luis Vizcaino were like the bad relievers, and they both had sub-4 ERAs in an era where that was like pretty awesome. So,
and then that team didn't even use their bullpen in the ALCS. Like, I keep like that. That's something I distinctly remember is the 2/3 innings total by Kotz in that series. And I mean my memories of this is also different because I had bedtimes back then. I was 10. My parents made me go to bed, and I like, or they'd say, oh, you can listen to the radio for the end of the game. I like the AJ called third strike thing, or dropped third strike, so listening to that on my radio, my parents didn't know I was awake. I was pretending to be asleep while listening to it on the radio.
I graduated from high school in 2005. I think, James, are you the same year as I am?
Yes.
Yeah, so I graduated from high school, and then I moved away from home. And the White Sox were such a me and my dad thing that it was in my freshman hall when they actually had the playoffs and won. And I'm actually gonna write something for this tomorrow, sort of along that narrative of me and my family. And when they clinched, I called home, and I was so excited because I wanted to talk to my dad. And they had like TiVo'd the game and hadn't finished yet. And he was like, oh, they must have won, huh? And I was like, yeah, you're not watching? He's like, yeah, we haven't finished yet. I was like, all right, great. This is a dude who's wished for a... I was like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing not like watching in real time? But, you know, this is a... I think he would have been 67 years old at that point. You know, lifelong White Sox fan. So, whoops.
Jeez.
I got kicked out of the section lounge of my dorm because Family Guy was coming on.
No.
And I went down to the basement of my dorm in Notre Dame, which had a huge fuck-off TV. So it was kind of great, but I was alone.
This further confirms everything that I suspect about Notre Dame. None of it's positive. My entire freshman hall was like so pumped just for me. I was the only White Sox fan there, except for Vegas Watch, who was a big Indians fan. He was rooting loudly for the Astros, just despite me.
Yeah, no one gave a shit. There was like another Sox fan in the section, but he was obviously mad casual because he was watching Family Guy that night.
I also was with people that didn't give a shit. I moved to Atlanta in the middle of that summer as well, and yeah. Nobody cared.
Nobody cared about the Braves in the playoffs at that point. We bought walk-up tickets to game one of the NLDS that year.
So when I watched game four, I was watching it with my parents because, again, 10 years old. And I think I celebrated by taking a Coke can and spraying it all over the place.
Aww.
What a mess.
Little scamp.
Because they wouldn't let me do the champagne stuff, and I wanted to celebrate.
I just watched like post game coverage until they like turned the cameras off. I was convinced I needed to soak in everything.
That's something that I've done with.
Were you just sitting alone in a basement?
Yeah,
there are couches.
You truly are the best blogger of all of us, James.
I heard rumors that other like Notre Dame Sox students like went running out into the quad and started celebrating, but I heard about that after the fact.
I would do the same. Like that's always been what I've done. No matter if the team I like or not is in the championship, I've always liked to just watch them stand like celebrating rather than like. I guess this was like definitely something I'd do more in baseball. I didn't do it, I guess, when Wisconsin went to the Final Four because I ran to State Street. But if it was like the White Sox again, I'd totally do that too.
You know, most of my memories, though, the specific memories I have of that playoff run are connected more to the lead up to the World Series and the World Series itself. I mean, the World Series, I guess, obviously had, you know, a couple really huge home runs. Some, you know, they were all really close games, but I don't know, for whatever reason, I like the ALDS, I was the most paranoid after, you know, after my prior playoff experience as a White Sox fan. I was like, man, they're going to have this amazing season, this really good team, and then they're just going to get, like, mushed into this obnoxious Red Sox narrative that we're in the middle of. I was just dreading that. And then
you just thought they're going to be annihilated by a bunch of, like, 35-year-old Japanese League players that the Mariners trotted out again?
Yeah, something like that. I just, I was like, you know, the media was so ready to just be like, you know, and understandably so, given 2004. But, you know, the David Ortiz and Manny Ramirez and blah, 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 blah. But then El Duque did his thing. And that first game, actually, I couldn't watch because I was in class. And I told my friend to text me what the score was because I didn't have a phone that could, like, look at the internet, and I didn't have a laptop to date this to 2005.
You didn't have, so people in 2005 didn't have laptops when they were freshmen in college?
They did. I didn't.
Okay.
It wasn't like ubiquitous. It was like,
you would fail your classes if you didn't have a laptop. This, like, no.
No, I had a nice computer. It was like a desktop.
Oh, okay.
So it was back in my dorm, and my buddy texted me. It was like, after the first inning, it was like, it's 5-0. I'm like, could you, like, tell me which team is winning? Because I'm just sitting here thinking.
Sox are winning.
Yeah, exactly. So that was just such.
I was in fourth grade, and my teacher was a big Red Sox fan, and she was giving me score updates. And it kept on getting worse for her and better for me, and that was fun. And then I came home from fourth grade class. I got home, and I turned it on. I think that game was on ESPN, and it was like.
Yeah.
It was like 9-1 when I got home or something like that.
Yeah, I got back to my dorm and people were watching the lobby. It was all Red Sox fans. And I walked in right when Podsednik hit a home run.
Yeah, I got home in a similar... I definitely saw the Podsednik home run and I laughed so hard.
Yeah.
My mom texted me, like, basically, like, live tweeting, like, live texted me the Canerico Grand Slam inning. I was on the train back from the airport after spending a week with my sister in New York.
I'm pretty sure I was asleep for the Clinico Grand Slam. I was asleep for Jeff Blum.
Between Jeff Blum and that game going till all hours of the night, and then obviously not being able to go to sleep immediately after the win, and my first experience with being in the Eastern time zone, I was an absolute zombie at work the next day, but... People at least, even though they didn't care about the White Sox, they at least understood that there was a reason that I just started the job like a couple weeks earlier. They understood that I was going to look like a zombie for the next couple of days, and there was really no helping it.
I guess college was a pretty good place to be for this, as long as you weren't at Notre Dame.
I mean, it was fine. Like, I watched game three with an extremely fatalistic Astros fan. So it wasn't as nerve-wracking as I thought it was going to be, because this guy was like, we're going to fuck it up. Oh, my God, we're done.
Right, because then you realize that to him, you're this, like, edifice of ruthless competence.
Right.
It's like, as opposed to a White Sox fan. You know what the other big thing I remember from that playoffs, isn't even with the White Sox, was the was when Pujols destroyed Brad Lidge. Because I remember everybody in my dorm, like, ran screaming out of the hallway when he hit that thing to the moon.
You know, people talk about how that Pujols shot destroyed Brad Lidge, but you could argue pretty easily, like, Albert Pujols is going to wreck, you know, a lot of baseballs, but giving up that shot to Scott Podsednik, that could break your will.
Oh, that's an interesting theory. That's an interesting theory. I like that.
Does this, like, narrative that, like, that ruined Brad Lidge vibe very well with him, like, closing out the 2008 World Series for the Phillies?
He was really fucking good with those.
He just needed 3 years of recovery, that's all.
Well, it's weird. He was weird, though, because, like, I'm just looking at it now. Like, he was incredible again in 2008, but he was abysmal in 2006, and then he was abysmal in 2009, and then he was really good again in, like, 2010. And
the narrative on Lidge was, yeah, that he was just toast after 05, and then 08 he turned into just did he go perfect in 08?
On save?
I want to say he was like 50 for... Yeah. I
thought 40, 41. He didn't have saves. He didn't have a loss. I don't see... where's
he was 41 for 41.
I don't know how to find blown saves as a stat on anything because I can't remember the last time I looked at it.
Probably something like 08. I still considered it an important stat in 08 because, well, I don't need to give my age for every year, but I was young.
He was, like, you know, bad in 2006. He struck out still, like, 104 guys in 75 innings.
That's like Dylan Betances shit.
Like, yeah, yeah, I mean, something was up with him, but he wasn't, like, washed up.
Well, if you hover, a little baseball reference tip, if you hover over the saves, it says blown saves and gives you percentages and holds and stuff.
What? That's so cool. God, baseball reference.
He had zero blown saves in 08. I was right. That's the kind of stuff that takes up memory space in my brain that should be going to my, like, studying. Like, Brad Lidge had a perfect 08.
Yeah. I
don't need to know that. Never need to know that again.
God, he's so good in 04. 157 strikeouts and 94 and two-third innings.
228 ERA plus in 04. In 2011, he had a 279. Oh, that was only in 25 games. Never mind.
But weren't some of those, I mean, those bullpens, they had some, not in 2004, but weren't there a couple years where it was like him and Dotel and like a couple other guys were really evil? They threw a perfect game, like a bullpen perfect game, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And he almost threw 100 innings in 2004.
Wait, who threw a bullpen perfect game?
The Astros did, with Lidge and Dotel and a couple other guys.
Why'd they pull a pitcher with a perfect game?
I think he got hurt.
Hmm.
Or maybe not.
Yeah, it wasn't a perfect game. I think it was just a no-hitter anyways, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't think a bullpen perfect game had ever been done. But...
Well, now I'm Googling, so you guys got to fill time.
That was such a weird Astros team. I mean, people talk about the White Sox being like... The White Sox really were like a team of a bunch of guys who like definitely had like career years, especially their entire bullpen. And you know that I kind of bristle at criticism that they're like a fluke because that is always going to be the case with like a championship team is that you're going to need guys to peak. But I feel like the Astros team is very much like even more so like 3 years ago, like where 3 years later, like where are any of these guys?
Well, half of them are like dead by then. Between 40, was Clemens like 41 that year?
Yeah, they had that old ass pitching staff of like legit stars, but like guys who were like approaching 40. Well, and they had like an offense based around Morgan Edsberg, who was like never that good again or even close.
And Jason Lane, who's like pitched last year or something.
Yeah, Jason Lane hit 26 bombs in 2005.
And like, the corpse of Jeff Bagwell.
Yeah. Oh, that was so sad.
I mean, he barely really contributed.
His Biggio was still competent, and then, like, Berkman was the main guy?
Yeah, Berkman was, like, a beast. They gave a ton of PAs to Mike Lamb, who was actively awful.
And he's a bigot now, too. That's a bummer.
Berkman?
Yeah.
Clarify, it's Berkman, not Mike Lamb.
I don't know. I don't know anything about Mike Lamb personally.
Yeah, don't send him to the slaughter.
Yeah. But you know what's sad is I just saw Mike Lamb's 703 OPS, and I was like, oh, that'd be good on the White Sox now.
Yeah, that was a 79 weighted runs created year for.
Did you guys see my amazing Juan Uribe stat from the other day?
Yes, that was a really good one. But say it again. I won't.
Juan Uribe in 2005 had the eighth best weighted run created plus on the White Sox of guys with 300 plate appearances or more. 10 years later, in 2015, if he were on the White Sox this year, he would have had the third best weighted run created plus of people with 300 plate appearances or more.
Hmm.
As a 36-year-old or 37-year-old this year, and he was 27. He should have been in his prime, and he was the eighth best player on the 2005 White Sox. And as a 37-year-old journeyman, he would have been the third best White Sox.
I was really adamant at the time when they got rid of him after 08 that it was the right thing to do.
Oh, it made sense.
He had three straight bad years,
and then he was good with the
Giants
for a bit, and then he was. He went to the Dodgers on a huge contract for his standards and then was terrible. And then he came out of nowhere and was suddenly like one of the best third basemen in baseball for a couple of years.
Yeah, the narrative of everyone laughed at the year, like, oh, we're going to keep giving Uribe these chances. Ha, ha, ha. Okay, have fun. And now it's like any team that wants to win needs Juan Uribe in the locker room.
I would be very okay with the Sox signing Juan Uribe next year. Not as a starting third baseman, but as a guy who gets 350 plate appearances. I'm fine with that.
I would be. I don't feel like they do that because I feel like they want Tyler Saladino around. For whatever reason.
Why?
In any case, I think they have enough, like, guys who can be utility infielders. I guess Uribe would still be better than all of them.
Uribe hits better than all of them and is still a pretty damn solid third baseman defender.
I don't feel like they get Uribe and then also get a real third baseman, is my concern.
That's probably a fair assessment.
Because, I mean, you've got four bench spots, one's a backup catcher. And then
I feel like if they did that, so. They'd be like, they use my love of Juan Uribe against me to field another crappy team.
Well, hopefully if they're sending Juan
Uribe, then resent the hell out of them for it.
It's because they're like sending Jason Hayward to play right.
Yeah, but that's such a White Sox thing to do. That's what I was talking about at the beginning, and I didn't say it very well, and I need to, like, maybe I should put in a big long essay about how they, like, this team, it seems designed to just try to, like, this organization's really dead set on cynically exploiting what they think will be the fan base's sentiments while using it to justify really, I don't know, asinine strategies. But by the way, I found the 2003 was that Houston bullpen where the top three were Wagner, Dotel, and Lidge. And
Jesus.
It was evil. And some guy named Ricky Stone was really good. Like run prevention wise. Not in terms of process, but
thank goodness Hawk Harrelson never got to call a reliever named Ricky Stone.
Same as same.
Oh, Bruce Chen was on that team.
Bruce Chen's been on so many teams.
Bruce Chen is in that photo at the end of The Shining.
Oh, and you got me clicking around too. You guys said he intentionally walked Francoeur twice. That was in one game. He did it again later in that series.
Oh hell yeah!
He got a third one in.
Did you guys see the Rick Hahn quotes where he basically was like, yeah, Ventura needs to be a better game manager?
Like, well, he said that when they fired Parent, right? They were
Like, it was actually like, I was surprised it didn't get more play because he pretty explicitly said that Robin Ventura sucks as a game manager.
Yeah, I think some of that, and this might have been strategic, got shifted onto, like, I know right away my mind went to, like, what are you blaming Parent for, like, stopping him from doing things? Like, is Parent the guy that's, like, against stats? Which, I mean, I guess he apparently was pretty old school, but if it was on purpose, that's a pretty good job of setting up some deflection by Rick Hahn.
But it's been 4 years. How many meetings have they had?
Yeah,
what
exactly.
Are they expecting to change?
Yeah,
like why now?
It's like when you're watching, like you're out in public somewhere and some kids acting like a 4-year-old's acting like a nightmare, and the parents just like, man, it's nothing I can do. If only I could do something about this. It's like, are you kidding? You have direct control of this. You have control over everything this person does. Like Rick Hahn, like
kid with another one.
You could call his cell phone, like as you're like he goes to throw pitch one of intentional walk to Jeff Francoeur. You could call his cell phone and be like, "What the hell are you doing?
If you finish this at bat, you're fired."
Yeah, exactly. Like when Kevin Youkilis squares to bunt, you could be like, "Dude, you will be fired before this inning is over." Like, stop.
There should be like an intercom in the dugout. Where Euclid squares the bunt, and Hahn's voice is just booming in the dugout, like, what the fuck is this?
Like, am I crazy? Like, people always say, like, well, you know, you don't want to, like, step on the manager's toes with that stuff. But, like, what, so you just sit there and let it happen over and over?
Yeah, honestly, that kind of baffles me. Because, like, Rick Hahn's, like he's definitely, like, he's not necessarily a total stat guy, but he's stat-based. And, like, does he not sit there just, like, fuming like we do at everything Robin Ventura does?
Because, like, you don't need a stat explanation for Euclid's not bunting there. Like, obviously there is one, but it's like, dude, this guy's never bunted
just
before.
As good, yeah.
He doesn't know how to do it.
The stat, like, explanation is total career sacrifice bunts by Kevin Euclid's.
Zero until that
day. Like, and the Jeff Francoeur thing is just, like, that is the epitome of Robin. He, like, tries to, like, he does the exact opposite of what makes sense. Like, he does, if I had to say this is the right decision, he so often does the literal polar opposite of that decision.
Do you ever
for
do you
no
ever
reason.
This, do you ever get the sense too that he's managing out of like some sort of sense of like fear, like he's already lost before he even? It's like, well, you know, the, you know, I can't go to my bullpen now because we'll just lose if we do that. Like he just, there isn't any confidence in what he's doing. He's just sort of like, I don't know. It feels all like ass covering and just kind of like he's fumbling about for whatever's the easiest thing to justify after. I don't know.
So is Ventura's ability or lack of ability, as we're discussing, do you think that is louder than most of the other managers in the league, or just because this is the team we watch for 160 games every year?
I think it's up there with it's. I mean, I know people who aren't White Sox fans who watch a decent amount of the White Sox who say that he is just brutal compared to their teams, and like, I watch a decent amount of other teams, and I don't feel myself making like this is such a stupid decision. But obviously, there's not emotional investment. I mean, I don't think he's like otherworldly terrible. Like he's not like three standard deviations from the mean in terms of terribleness. But like he makes more bad decisions than you should be making as a manager. From my impression, he's definitely bad even for managers. Even by the standard of managers who aren't necessarily great game managers in the first place.
I mean, people can learn. People can definitely learn. Like Clint Hurdle is the most extreme example of that, where Clint Hurdle, Rockies manager, is so different from Clint Hurdle, Pirates manager now. And people have written about how
there's something in the water out there in Colorado.
Yeah, obviously the organizational situations play a part of it. But apparently, while he was without work, he was like, all right, well, what can I do to get better, and dedicate himself to learning and trying to learn from his mistakes, which, you know, I don't know. You can't count on everybody going from one extreme to the other like that. But it's just weird watching like the first Austin Powers movie when that guy gets run over by the steamroller and it takes like 2 minutes. It's like, dude, just step out of the way of the steamroller. It's just so weird seeing Rick Hahn watch Ventura make the same dumb mistakes over and over and over again. There's no rhyme or reason. It doesn't matter really, but there was no rhyme or reason as to when Abreu was hitting second or not. He doesn't have a plan. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing. It's almost like he'd never managed before and didn't even want the job.
I kind of hope my dream situation is so they hire Manny Acta as the bench coach or Rick Renteria. They have a really big offseason. They make the team a lot better. Like, get, like, Hayward and David Fries or something. And then they start off 0-8 and fire Robin. And then they put Acta as the manager and end up winning 89 games and winning the division.
I mean, that would work. I know that I've seen some backlash against Acta from some people thinking that he's like a lot more hype than substance, but I know that there are a lot of people who really like him. I had a positive impression of him, and I never thought that he really got a fair shake, because it's not like those rosters he had were any good in Washington and in Cleveland.
I like Rick Renteria a lot, too.
Me too. I really like Rick Renteria.
Other than Dave Martinez, who you're not getting from the Cubs, I think that dude would be a really nice bench coach, and a really nice, if you fire Robin, he's going to take over coach.
I think you need a dude who's out of the work, because the Rick thing Renteria, I need to understand with Sandy Alomar is, why are you getting aboard this obviously sinking ship?
Renteria is out of work, though.
Yeah. I think it would need to be someone like that, because Ventura is clearly like on the ropes.
This is a window, James. We're in a winning window.
Yeah, they won more games than last year, James.
I mean, I also don't think the 3-year winning window is irrational, but it just has to be supplemented with actual talent acquisition, not like a bunch of mid-tier free agent signings that are all less than $60 million. Like,
it's not irrational, I just don't know if it's genuine.
Right, it's rational, but the issue is you can't, you're like, this is what my last article was about. You can't do what they're doing and then sign Colby Rasmus and David Fries and call it an off season. You need to do it what they're doing and either trade for a Todd Frazier or sign a Jonas Cespedes or a Justin Upton or even a Ben Zobrist or Alex Gordon. And Hayward's obviously the pipe dream, but that's what you need to do. That's the only way this actually becomes a window. You don't have the talent in the minor leagues to acquire talent without spending money, because you're if you trade Tim Anderson, your positional farm system is just as bad as it's been in any year in the past. Mm-hmm. And if you trade anyone in the major leagues, your major leagues just get that much worse, even if you're getting a position of strength. You really just need to spend money, and they can do that, but they can win if they fill holes with stars, but the only way to get stars is to spend money right now.
Like, the only prospect I can think of substance other than Tim Anderson, who doesn't have some sort of like value for them for 2016 to actually compete, is like Spencer Adams, right? Because I mean Fulmer maybe,
you know, Fulmer probably be on the but 20s. Like, I would be shocked if Fulmer doesn't pitch in the majors in 2016.
I don't think you right. can trade Fulmer but, yet, though.
No, you can't. No. They changed the rule after the trade Turnership.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, you can trade him in the off season after.
So it's a 3 month thing.
I think you could probably trade Danish for something, not like something big, but like I was thinking, like the Marlins probably don't want to spend pay Martin Prado $11 million anyway.
Yeah.
And he'd mostly just offer to eat money and, like, hey, here's Tyler
Danish. Danish is the totally kind of prospect you include as, like, in something like the Samardzija deal. And obviously the Samardzija deal was awful. Like, it didn't turn out right. But, like, if you can get one of those type of guys, I mean, I don't know what – one thing that I'm definitely interested in is in what the Rockies want for Carlos Gonzalez, because I think they're going to go in full sell mode. But, I mean, that might be like a Montas type, but – honestly, any of those pitchers, I'm totally fine with moving. I just don't want to move.
I am too. There's a lot of moves, but I'm just saying, like, as is right now, unless there's some sort of corresponding move, like let's say you move Eric Johnson or whatever it is, or Montas, like, yeah, you can definitely afford to part with those guys, but you're going to need to, especially with Eric Johnson, like, you know, you can't count on your starting pitching staff going injury free for an entire season again. You could, but I'm just kidding. You know what I'm saying, though? Like, Eric Johnson is your starting pitching depth, and there are budget guys you could pick up
I think Eric Johnson is fungible,
but you're going to need to do something else. You can't just – I don't think that your sixth starter is of Chris Beck is, like, a competitive – that's not what a competitive team
has. I think that even if they don't – well, Fulmer, Montas could hypothetically be your sixth starter, but that probably is something you don't want to do with but I think the there's a lot of those fifth starter types. The Sox haven't signed one of those guys in a while because they haven't needed to. But if you're like, if you need innings, there are a lot of guys on the market that are going to be able to give.
That's what I'm saying, though. You do need a corresponding move, though, if you're going to do that.
Right. No, but I think you could get one of those guys for a couple million dollars and not be like a Justin Masterson thing.
Or the Felipe Paulino thing.
The only prospect who really moves the needle that wouldn't affect your 2016 roster in some way is Spencer Adams, I think.
Yeah.
Right? Presuming that you don't move Tim Anderson.
Right. I mean, yeah, Anderson's not going to hurt your 2015. If Anderson's hurting your 2016, then you're doing something else wrong.
Or Tim Anderson just, like, hits his 95th percentile and goes
right.
super.
Yeah, he has a Carlos Correa year.
Or he gets promoted to Charlotte in a rush job and then has, like, a good first 3 weeks, and they just promote him to the majors forever.
Well, the head of your minor league system is on the record as saying he doesn't see any difference between any of the levels in the minor leagues. He thinks the only jump that matters is from minors to the pros.
That's not a crazy stance.
I don't know. He's the only dude I've heard who said it.
I feel like that's probably a little, like, that seems like a little over-exaggerated, but I think definitely the biggest jump is the major leagues, and there's just different aspects of the different minor league levels that, like,
it is the biggest jump, but he basically, I was on the phone with him, Buddy Bell, he's just like, because somebody said, like, don't you think that, they were talking about Courtney Hawkins, they were like, don't you think you rushed him, he was like, no, I think that was a confidence thing, and it's like, all right, dude, you're clearly, far be it from us to question White Sox position player development. I mean, I guess you can just rest on your laurels as far as that goes. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm very leery of all of that.
Is anyone excited about the World Series? I'm excited.
Absolutely.
I've seen some 2005 White Sox stuff.
You what?
I hope they do some... I hope the Mets pull some 2005 White Sox stuff and just... shut the Royals down and make them look bad.
Everyone seems to intensely hate the Royals.
I do.
don't know. I've kind of made peace with it because at this point they're already like, they've already like super validated like whatever crazy positioning they want to take, and no one will ever question them ever because they won back to back pennants. I don't know. The horse is out the barn door.
It's easier this year because they're actually. Last year it was strictly like just these little dinky little stupid hits and speed. I mean, and they were doing a good job exploiting what they needed to exploit as far as, you know, the way the league set up, the way their park set up and all that. So, I mean, it worked and I get it. But at least this year they're actually like hitting the ball harder. It seems like it's a little easier to swallow, I guess, is my point.
Zobrist and Cueto are like really good. And
the pitching
thing's
kind of annoying still. But what are you going to do?
They're starting Edison Volquez in the first game of the World Series when they have their entire staff rested.
And washed Cueto in the second.
Yeah, Kansas City Royals fans, like, hate Johnny Cueto. I guess
he's going to lose a good amount of money this offseason because of how he's done with the Royals. Like,
man, game
five.
He was
showing that with his last few starts with the Reds. Didn't he have, like, a couple, like, kind of breakdown moments where he couldn't find the zone and it looked like there was just something really going on?
It was like, that was all like after Brian Price put him out for that inning against the White Sox in the ninth when they were up by like 15. He just didn't need to do, and then Jose Abreu had a dong off him.
I know like first half, second half is stuff that people put too much stock in, blah, blah, blah. But I think for a pitcher, especially a guy who's like concern is his build is that he, you know, because he's a shorter guy, and that was always the knock on him when he was coming up was durability and stamina. I mean, he's been a significantly worse pitcher in the second half for his entire career, and I think there are guys who do that. I feel like Dan Heron did that for a lot of his career, and I don't know. Is it that crazy to say that there are some guys who just kind of wear down over the course of the season? And
I think that's definitely possible. I think it's hard to find those guys out just by stats, but I think that Cueto would definitely be there'd be red flags there, especially because he's also had a lot of years where his best years, I think last year, didn't he have like 175 innings or something like that? Most of his best years, he's missed a little bit of time.
No, he had a 244 inning season.
Oh, okay. Was it a couple years ago then? He's had injuries where he's had like 26.
Yeah. Seasons. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The first 4 years in the majors, he capped at 185 and he was throwing 150, 170. And then he had 60 in 2013, and then he came back through 244 and 212 this year.
I think Lorenzo Cain is, like, a phenomenally cool player that I will probably tell, like, later generations about having watched. And the idea that there's some crowning achievement to, like, his really weird and really fun peak is what I'm trying to make peace with out of all this. That's my two cents on it.
Not the glory of Alex Rios. Finally.
Alex Rios' playoff hero is also pretty funny, but that's kind of like a that's
it
a
is
side
funny.
Dish.
It
the
is...
collective groan when he was having a success in the ALCS across White Sox Twitter was very amusing to me.
Oh yeah, Alex Rios like lighting up R.A. Dickey in the ALCS is just like that's such a gut punch for me.
Matt, how much Alex Rios satisfaction do you take just from the fact that you sat next to that guy who heckled him for like all 2011?
Oh, I think about it every time he does something well. Every single time.
Eric Hosmer's been terrible these playoffs, and I'm checking Moustakas also.
For whatever reason, I just like it when Moustakas and Hosmer suck.
Same. Well, they both have neither of them has cracked a 600 OPS in either playoff series this year.
For some reason, Hosmer doesn't bother me as much as Moustakas really eats me up, though. Every time he does anything, I want him I want him to fail miserably every
sucks.
Time he does.
Like, he had a really good playoffs, and then this year he had a really high BABIP and, like, had an okay year. And after,
he had more
like,
than an okay year.
Did he?
Yeah, 817.
Okay, yeah. That with his defense, that's really good.
That would be, like, the best White Sox third baseman year in, like, a decade.
Maybe longer.
Well, that's not
I don't
saying
know.
Much.
I don't know if Creedy ever had a 350 OBP. Although Creedy's glove was obviously better. Oh, look at Mike Moustakas' profile photo, too. Tell me you don't want to just, like punch that guy in the face. Maybe that's the secret
sure that
underneath
turned
all
south
these...
on me really fast.
Maybe that's all these Royals brawls is really just people looking at Mike Moustakas' photo and just being like, oh, no, I'm not, no more.
Which photo is this?
Well, and it's Toronto Ventura who, like, he stares down Tulowitzki, or he stared down Tulowitzki and then got himself psyched out and then just lost all feel for his pitches.
Oh yeah, Ventura going around like trying to like bully everybody as like a really mediocre pitcher is hilarious. And
the funny thing, he looked like a not really mediocre pitcher against the Blue Jays. Like, his fastball had life on it. He cut down the velocity, but his fastball had a lot more life. He had better control, and his curveball looked like an actual pitch. Then he gets mad and starts throwing his fastball 98, 99 again, and everything sucks again. Like,
because he's a baby. His diaper gets full, and then he, I don't know.
If he could just calm down and hit, like, 94, 96 with that awesome life and that 86-mile-an-hour hammer, like, that works really well.
But I've never even heard of somebody getting a thumb cramp before, and it happened to him.
Was he squeezing the baseball too hard?
That was not
rage.
His injuries, like, he gets a million. I don't know. I'm wondering if he's going to be like, I call it Chipper Jones syndrome in my head, where it's like he's always hurt, but it's never devastating. I wonder if he's going to be one of those guys.
He's got the body for that. I mean, that's like the reason they didn't think Pedro Martinez was going to do anything and sent him out of Los Angeles.
Hmm.
No, the season's long, so.
Like, there's no comeuppance really coming for this Royals team. Like, Ned Yost is going to be, like, permanently regarded as a genius in Kansas City. Like, everything that we wanted to not happen has happened. And
as he hits Alex Gordon eighth or whatever?
Yeah, they might as well just win it. I don't know. Who cares?
Yeah, the one legitimate player they have, best eighth.
That's the thing, is like, you know, as we come out of this and it's like, okay, we've all agreed that Dayton Moore is a genius for some reason. Like, I'm trying to identify the things that he objectively did really well and the things that he did poorly.
He built a team that synergizes, like, as a sum of its parts way better than it actually is. And I think that's really impressive. I think that the way that team plays up because it's defense and it's speed, despite having really a garbage pitching rotation before they got Cueto, and an offense that really isn't all that impressive, to be able to still win a lot because of the bullpen and because of the
Robin
defense.
Ventura.
Like, yeah, like I think that's not nothing. I think he's done a very good job, and like his Rio sucks, but he's like, he's been a fine stopgap and right. Morales was a really good signing, and I thought he was an idiot for that signing. So.
Yeah, no, here's my thing, is like,
trade return is pretty good.
That's what I was getting. So Moore has done some really good things. Like, the Greinke trade return was just superb. I think he did Sal Perez, which is obviously a victory. And like you said, Morales is a great acquisition. Volquez has clearly worked out fine. But then I just look at what he's done with all the top 10 picks that he had, and I'm just like so underwhelmed by it.
Yeah, that's a good point. His drafting record is, at least in the first round, is like Hosmer and Moustakas, who been okay. Cologne, who's a bust. Was he there for Hochever, or was that before him?
I think that was before, but remember, he inherited Alex Gordon.
Yeah.
And Billy Butler.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying he's, like, as terrible as he seemed for a long time, by the way. But part of the defense for him, I've seen people, you know, it gets really circular, some of these arguments, and so maybe it's not worth everybody's time, but, you know, one of the defenses is like, well, he drafted Will Myers really late. It's like, yeah, and then he traded him for, I believe, a talent that he could have basically replicated for only money. And remember, Shields, he got for, like, Shields was not cheap, like, money-wise either, especially for the team. And then he turned around and spent $60 million on Omar Infante and Jason Vargas. Like, he's not great.
Vargas is pretty good for them before he blew out his elbow.
I mean, his one, like, pretty good season, especially given, like, what the environment he was doing it in, is that worth, like, a four-year, $30-something million deal?
I mean, this is the environment Vargas has lived in his entire life. I hate Jason Vargas, but I don't know. I think they got what they expected to get.
But in an offseason where Jose Abreu cost $68 million, you spent $62 million on Infante and Vargas.
Oh, I pilloried them for that at the time.
And then you turn around and have to sign Morales like a year later.
Yeah, I thought they were playing to be a third-place team that looked nice when they signed Jason Vargas as the centerpiece of their offseason movement, and then they won the pennant, so...
For all the people who said the Shields trade worked out perfectly, like, if they lose that wild card game against Oakland and then they're throwing all this bad money trying to fill these holes that were created by that trade, do we still think Dayton Moore's a great GM?
I think he probably gets validated to some degree because they got to that freaking wild card game and they had absolutely nothing in the way of, like, playoff appearance or viability for two decades. So I think they had a kind of a blank check.
Well, I'm just saying. I'm just asking questions, James.
I think it's fair. I just have no hope of ever reclaiming the Royals conversation in the way we talked about them 2 years ago, ever again.
Which is sad.
They've already won too much.
Because I like them being the team in the AL Central that I knew the White Sox would be better than, no matter what.
And now you've learned the ultimate lesson, which is you can never really trust that the White Sox are better than anyone.
Tigers.
No, maybe I was going to say the Marlins, just because the Marlins basically get the same results. Somebody pointed this out the other day, and this is killing me because it was somebody I want to give credit to. But they pointed out that it made me realize that the White Sox have basically done what the Marlins have done, but like for like $60 million more a year.
I forget who it was too, but that, yeah, kind of right. I mean, the Marlins do have the benefit of a lot of high first round picks too. The White Sox don't necessarily have. I mean, they were
they got 140 innings from one this year.
they consistently got draft picks like Yelich and was Ozuna a draft? I want to say Ozuna was a. Is he an internet? No, he's Dominican. But Fernandez was a top 10 draft pick. Yelich was a top 10 draft pick.
Yeah, but Fernandez and Sale are pretty much offsetting, right?
Yeah.
Sale's better. Or because he didn't miss the injury.
Fernandez, who has perfect mechanics by the book, has already had way more DL time than Sale has ever in his career.
Mm. I don't know. I'm just saying, if you're going to win 70-something games and, like, not hit at all, the White Sox cheap out right before they sign, like, a player that might actually put them over the top, whereas the Marlins don't pretend that they're they're not all in. The Marlins are the Marlins.
They did 1 year, then they got out of it like in 4 months.
Isn't it kind of funny that the White Sox have now twice in the last handful of years had teams kind of referred to as all in, but like, you know, that salary list that came out on MLB Trade Rumors the other day, they have, you know, they're in the bottom fourth.
Did you not read my article? I literally wrote, just fuck this. Like, they can't do this.
Yeah, it was actually your article that brought me to it. But, yeah.
Okay.
I snuck a sentence into Ethan's article that is a point that nobody's ever really addressed to my satisfaction, which is that, you know, the White Sox payroll has bounced between $90 and $120 million, depending on the year. I guess $125, depending on the season. For the last like decade, but their highest seasons are all in their rearview mirror in terms of assets. But revenues have gone way up across the league.
Have gone up like 50%.
When they say they're going all in this year, this is one of the things that I found is total bullshit. Is that they're saying they're going all in this year with a payroll that might have been all in 2010, but it was below league median this year, or it was right at league median this year. They were outspent by the Royals and the Orioles. You can't do that.
And it's all like, you know, oh, well, they're scared to do a really huge deal and get an elite player, but then they just do death by 1,000 cuts and spend the money. And dumb teams do this. Like, back in the biggest days of small market teams complaining about how they can't compete, you know, when the Pirates were losing 100 plus games every year and blah, 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 blah. We haven't heard as much about that lately as more parity has set in. But those bad teams, it's not that they didn't spend money. I mean, obviously that didn't help, but they spent it on mid-level free agents, and I just don't know that there's any value there. Not really.
Mid-level free agents are fine.
Like, it can. Like, yeah.
If you're doing what the Royals did with their mid-level free agents this year, if you're plugging it's nice to plug a hole, but it's not going to fix a bad team.
Well, build a core out, or prime, I guess, like secondary offensive options out
right.
of it.
Right. No, what the Sox need to do is they have this great cheap core. They're paying like $35 million in 2017 or 2016 to Sale, Quintana, Abreu, Rodon, and Eaton. Like, that's a fantastic core for not much money.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to supplement that with more star talent. And I mean, if you have a core of those five guys and Hayward for a total of $60 million, that's a really good core for still really cheap. That's $10 million a year on average, six like stars to superstars between those six players.
Yeah, and they're doing here's the analogy I want to make. Like, the type of contract that they've been doing in terms of keeping their payrolls up in the middle or sometimes near the top third has been on, like, it's the Jose Guillen contract, you know, where the Royals signed Jose Guillen for like $36 million. It's like, oh, see, we're spending money, but it's just terrible money. Like, just, yeah, Robinson Cano is a really long contract and it's really terrible, but at least he's like going to be really good for a little while.
Yeah, and I still, like, I don't think that contract, I mean,
I don't think it's a good contract either, but at least you get something out of it.
I was actually saying I don't think that contract is all that bad. I kind of was confused by why they did it when they were doing it, because they weren't that in the right place on the win curve, in my opinion.
And evidently they bid against themselves a little bit, so maybe if you knock.
But at least when that team's trying to prove something with their spending, they're actually proving something with a real player.
Yeah.
Like a real star.
Got like a Hall of Famer in his like late 20s.
Right. And the White Sox hypothetically could do that with Hayward. I'm not saying Hayward's going to make the Hall of Fame. He's actually going to be, except maybe Jose Reyes, he's going to be the worst $100 million contract hitter. Like, no one who's gotten $100 million has ever been as bad of a hitter as Jason Hayward. And not that he's not a great hitter, not a good hitter, but he's like a 120 weighted run created plus. And most guys getting that money are a lot better than that. But
if he just, like, started next year and hit, like, 30 bombs a season for the next 5 years, no one would really blink either.
Yeah, and that would probably be building the tools of a Hall of Fame career, too. I mean, his numbers through 26 comp similarly to guys like Bonds and McCutcheon. Like,
that's okay. Those are okay, guys.
But his numbers through 26 also comp very similarly to one Adam Eaton, and the race and physical comps are perfect there too, I think.
You're getting a little controversial for my taste. For my brand, certainly.
Adam Eaton, Jason Hayward, and Trace Thompson in the same outfield. Be a nice little, like,
that would be a lot of fun.
Gradation.
Maybe Sale would have a BABIP that's not 340 for a year or something like that.
Oof.
Like, I know Sale was definitely getting pounded on balls in play to an extent, but the balls were being hit hard.
Spalding balls.
Yeah, that's my name. But it definitely had in part to do with his defense, that he like had a historically good strikeout rate to walk rate. Like, he had an amazing, he had an almost 12 strikeout rate and a walk rate under 2, and ZRA is in the mid threes. Like, that has to do with your defense a little bit.
I keep their defensive efficiency as a team was just so bad. Like, and that's the only defensive metric I ever really cite, just because I know what it represents. But
yeah, team defensive efficiency is a pretty like satisfactory way of saying what happens.
Yeah, so like retrospect, I don't know what its predictive value is and like what caused necessarily what it was, but just as a matter of like how many balls were put into play and how many of them were converted into outs. Like, it's very clear to me. And the 2005 White Sox were fantastic at it.
The 2015 White Sox were basically league average at it at home, and on the road they were like the worst team by a mile. It was
2015.
Did I say 20? What did I say?
You said 2005. I thought.
Oh, I meant 2015. it was like, it's really bizarre. Like, they were fine at home, and on the road, they, like, gave up a 330 BABIP. And that's really part of what, like, that's why I was talking about this with some guys who were doing park effect stuff, and, like, I was like, why is this happening? And they didn't, like, it didn't make sense.
I mean, they were, I guess their home road splits were pretty rough this year, right? Just generally?
Yeah. I think they were fine at home. I mean, they didn't hit at home. They didn't hit anywhere.
Coincidentally, the 2005 White Sox won, like, 54 road games or something ridiculous.
Yeah, I remember getting, 18-year-old me getting super indignant about the fact that ALDS, it was like, well, the Red Sox are the best home team in MLB. And I was like, the White Sox road record is better. Like,
I don't think a team since that Sox team has won that many road games, or maybe the Cardinals did this year, but
I was about to throw that out there.
The Cardinals this year, or no one's done it since. Like, that team was historically good on the road.
I guess. Cause like, outside of, I mean, cause this US Cellular was such a hitter's park at the time. I mean, it was really hard to score on them, I imagine, like in any neutral or pitcher friendly environment.
They're 52-29 on the road. They gave up 302 runs in 81 games.
Jesus. In that era?
3.7 runs per game, which is probably still better than this year's White Sox offense, but different environment.
That's insane. 3.7 runs per game on defense.
They tuned up Detroit and Kansas City to the tune of 27-10 over that year. Equally vicious towards Cleveland, went 14-5 against them. Pretty much killed their playoff hopes. Minnesota, they only went 11-7 against.
Yeah, didn't they sweep Cleveland with their bench in like the last three games and like kill them?
Yeah, to knock off their wild card spot. I watched that with like a diehard Indians fan. Just like laughing, it was like Ross Colon who killed
was the same one that wanted the Astros to beat the White Sox.
That was me.
Oh,
that was me. I was at that point. Once the White Sox clinched, I was still at a point where I would have preferred the Indians to make it, and then the Red Sox or Yankees, because I was so sick of Red Sox Yankees at that point.
Being on the East Coast probably had to deal with that too.
Yeah, it didn't help.
But it probably was even sweeter when the Sox just murked the Red Sox.
This is such a cool team to do random BREF diving in.
Because they were so weird and so good. Like,
so they beat the Tigers 14 out of 19 games. They outscored them 99-52. They beat the Indians 14 out of 19 games. They outscored them 80-75.
They just beat
the Indians in a ton of one-run games.
Looking at defensive efficiency, the White Sox were second, tied for second in 2005 with a team BABIP of 275. They're actually tied with the Indians. The A's were first with 271, which is like, I feel like that's probably absurd. Now I want to look at like the 2005 A's and see what the hell they were doing.
I was kind of terrified of the 2005 A's because at that point was when we had that big
curse.
The A's murdered the White Sox no matter what happens. So I really thought the Sox were going to face the A's in the playoffs, and that would be that.
Yeah, I was always very scared. It wasn't just the A's, like it was just particularly the A's, but I felt like it was a West Coast thing too. Like, I think the Angels pounded on the White Sox too, and I was scared about that ALCS a lot with Bartolo Colon going game one and Vladimir. I was scared shitless of Vladimir Guerrero, rightfully so.
Yeah, I mean, like, I wasn't even upset when Vlad did stuff against him just because I liked him so much. Yeah, that A's team was like, you can see why their defense was so good.
They went 2-7 versus the A's. They got outscored by 16 runs. Only AL West team they beat up on was the Mariners.
That A's team underperformed their Pathetic by 5 games because Billy Bean can't catch a break, I guess.
Didn't the A's this year have a positive Pathetic too?
No, but it was, I don't know if it finished positive.
It stayed positive until really late.
It was like way better than their results.
And Marcus Semien's defense overwhelmed them.
MVP Marcus Semien.
That was a fun couple weeks.
I'm seeing Kirk Sarlous's name way more than I thought I would when I went into this podcast. As I click around. And Mark Kotze's baseball reference profile photo, he looks like Fast Times pretty hard. But I also, the White Sox took that huge leap in BABIP in defensive efficiency that year. Their defensive efficiency this year, the BABIP allowed was 311 as a team.
There's a way to sort by home and road. It's like, it's really bizarre how bad they were on the road for their defensive efficiency. If you guys I want to say it was like almost 330 that they gave up on the road away.
Do you mind if I'm going to ask a question while you're looking? So James had his piece about third base today, and Heyman had his update about, you know, where the White Sox are as they head into the offseason. And it was talking about how, you know, it mentioned third base sort of first and foremost as a priority. Mentioned catcher as well, which, you know, I don't feel as fussed about changing. And, you know, sort of weighing third base versus right field. And I understand that those, I feel like they're different resources that you can devote to it, because as James sort of pointed out, that like the free agent market for third base, there isn't really much there. Whereas obviously there's this top end.
There's a lot of decent. There's not a stud. Like, there's not a Jason Hayward to go after.
Right. Or, I mean, I'd be thrilled with Justin Upton, frankly. But
I don't think there's even somebody that good.
Right. No, there isn't.
Like,
there
I think Zobrist would be as good as Upton next year, but he's not, like, sign him for seven seasons.
No, I'd be thrilled with Justin Upton just period. I think he's great. But you're right. They're, like, it's, you know, trade options, free agency, and you're all looking at a bunch of, like, certainly upgrades for this team. But then I guess the flip side of it would be, I feel like if the White Sox sign a huge right fielder, which they, I just know that they won't, but I feel like they're not going to spend any money on anything else. And while I'd be fine with that, the one factor that's sort of in my mind is that if you had to fix a position internally, right field versus third base, I think you could say we can play Trace Thompson as right fielder with a straight face and have it not be terrible. Whereas I don't think you have that option at third base. That's something, and I don't know if you guys are with me on that or if you think that that matters at all in the analysis.
I wouldn't say it's a straight face. I might flinch a little when I said it, but it's not like an impossibility that it could work out.
Part of the Trace Thompson thing is I think he could play right field and not be terrible, but I also think kind of my ulterior motive with getting a corner outfielder is that you kind of want someone to leech away DH opportunities from Adam LaRoche.
And then you put Melky at DH a lot?
Yeah. And just give guys days off that way.
No, I think that's look, I'm definitely in the right field huge free agent camp. Like, that's what I want. But in terms of evaluating like how much of an upgrade it would be, I don't know. I mean, it's just like Saladino everyday third baseman, I think, is so much worse than Trace Thompson everyday right fielder.
Yes. Saladino is also far and away the most competent guy they put at third base this year. Connor Gillespie's peak appears to have been 3 months long. And some guys don't get that, so credit to him. But, man, him and Mike Ault are so terrible.
I'm still rooting for Connor wherever he winds up. I hope his foot gets better and his major league pension accrues.
Watching with the Angels, like with the glint of fanhood away from me, it was just like, oh, my God, Mike Scioscia's going to cut this guy. He's going to take him off the field and then tell him to turn in his uniform.
But he's already so Eeyore-esque. So sad.
Maybe because he knows what's hanging over him.
What's hanging over him?
I don't know. Maybe he's like one of those guys who like saw how he would die at an early age, and now he just thinks about it all the time. That happens, right?
James, I can't prove you're wrong. I can't prove that that's not what happened.
I think the how has something to do with batting gloves, which is why he has that hole.
His hands just really hurt. Oh, my God. These four names at third base. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Saladino was by far the best third base option.
And I wonder how much I have to, like, mess with Robin's head. Where, I don't know. He seems to be, like, very comfortable in settling with, like, well, at least this guy will fill this position.
I mean, that was, like, the entire infield save for Abreu. And then the opposite of the outfield.
I think second half Alexi was good.
Yeah, that's true. Alexi comes back for a whole season like the Sox. That's a really nice shortstop to have, I guess.
I also think the idea of I want Alexi to play like this all year is something we've been chasing for like 8 years.
He did it in 2014, and he's really fucking good.
Even then, he kind of tailed off. He just like had such a nuclear hot first half.
But James, how much of you pointed this out where like Micah Johnson was clearly like driving Alexi insane the first half?
Alexi went back to normal, and then like Micah Johnson played two games and he's already running over to the second base side again.
Do you think that there's any, is this too much of a like homer fan hope driven thing to think, okay, like give him a competent defensive second baseman to work with and he should be like back to his roughly his old self?
You could definitely preserve him that way.
The operative word there is definitely old self, and preserve is probably also useful somewhere there.
Old man Adams throwing stones in his glass house.
He's an old shortstop. I'm a full like 2 weeks older than Alexi. I know of what I speak.
I mean, it's like the same thing with like NBA players. Like someone like in his 30s can come off the bench and give you like 15, 20 good minutes, but if you play him like 35 minutes a night, he's going to be terrible. Like Alexi could cover like shortstop range really solidly, but if you ask him to like, I don't think he can cover like his crazy elite range territory like he used to.
No, but like I still think, so you play him 140 games instead of 160.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing with like how do you get him to like stop off like this Mad Max workload.
But then see, that's the thing, like is Ventura really that, you remember when he would go out and try to like pull Jake Peavy even though it was like overwhelmingly the correct thing to do, and then Peavy would yell at him and Ventura would forget that he was in charge and like sulk off with his tail between his legs. And then
who in life has successfully used a good hook on Jake Peavy? I feel like this is tested across multiple managers at this point.
But like, didn't Bud Black?
Bochy did. Bochy's really fucking good at his job.
He is, but even then I've seen plenty of Giants fans complain about Jake Peavy arguing his way to stay in games. Like, I think Jake Peavy is an above average argue to stay in games guy.
Yeah.
I mean, no. Every time a manager walks out there, he's not necessarily throwing the hook. Sometimes he just wants to have a pitcher do that. He wants to get him fired up a little bit and say, okay, go ahead and do it. I think sometimes there's some design in that. I'm not saying necessarily that's what Robin Ventura does, because I don't think we should probably give him that much credit. But
what psychopath is trying to get Jake Peavy more fired up?
Ditto with Chris Sale, because you don't want
to. Oh, yeah. His rage fastballs are so, like, you could just, it's so easy to point to. But anyway.
His rage fastballs are really fun when they're on 0-2 counts and his other stuff is working. But otherwise, they're just like, he's missing a ton.
Well, happy 10 years, guys. I hope the White Sox make the playoffs before Ethan turns 30.
What do we think is going to happen in the World Series?
Mets in 6.
Mets, please.
I want the Mets to win so badly, so Royals in 6.
I say Royals in 7.
How about an over-under on Daniel Murphy home runs?
11.5.
I bet he doesn't hit one.
No, that's the line for the over. So you're going under.
I'm going under.
You're going under 11.5.
It's Royals in 7, and Alex Gorton gets sent this time, and David Wright like cocks his arm for like the relay throw and his back screams at him and it's like the saddest major league moment ever.
Strikes out 3 times against Noah Syndergaard in extra innings in a 7th inning game.
It's post 2014 wildcard game Royals. What's gonna happen is Alex Rios is gonna hit a walk off line drive off of like Matt Harvey's face and like end his career.
Can't feel my face, man, I'm with you. And I love it.
I say, like, Terry Collins, like, leaves Syndergaard warming up in the bullpen and Addison Reed loses the world championship.
I think you're right. I think that's correct.
Did you see the picture of Addison Reed at press day today?
Oh, no. It made me so sad.
Yeah, everybody's, like, you know, jammed around different reporters and media people around different players. And there's Addison Reed just sitting there on his phone with everyone at, like, the booth next to him.
He's texting Matt Davidson.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been a massively long podcast with no particular narrative focus, so I think we can call it.
So it's a Catbird Seat podcast.
Yes, it is.
Go Mets.
Success.
Night, guys.
Later.